Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, we'll feature part two of our live Valentine's Day show at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, and we'll start off with the man behind the Modern Love column, editor Daniel Jones.
I'm going to read just a short piece that is called How We Write About Love, because I've read probably 80,000 essays about love over 12 years I've been doing this. So these are the lessons I've learned, some of them. How we write about love. When I first started this job more than 12 years ago, I hardly knew anything about love. In fact, a journalist who interviewed me early on in my job said at one point, "So you're like a male Carrie Bradshaw." And I had no idea what she was talking about. I'd never heard of Carrie Bradshaw. I actually thought that she said I was like a male Terry Bradshaw, the former Steelers quarterback, now Fox sports commentator, who I'd grown up idolizing in my suburban Pittsburgh childhood. This was confusing to me on so many levels. First, what did Terry Bradshaw have to do with editing personal essays about relationships? And second, Terry Bradshaw was male. He already was a male Terry Bradshaw. It was like 3 months before I figured it out. But over the years, I've learned that I'm not the only one who's a little stupid about this stuff. Love is hard. Writing about love is even harder. When some people write about love, they can't find the right words to capture the intensity of their feelings. So they rely on stock terms like amazing, gorgeous, incredible, and electrifying. And then there's everybody's favorite stock term, regardless of subject, literally, as in, our dinner date was literally electrifying. Women and men may feel love in the same way, but they write about it differently. A lot of women's stories bristle with impatience. They want to figure love out. Many keep mental lists of their expectations, detailing the characteristics of their dream partner with alarming specificity. And then testing how each new romantic interest does or does not match that type. They write things like, "I always pictured myself with someone taller, a guy with cropped brown hair and wire-rimmed glasses, who wears khakis or jeans, the kind of person who would bring me tea in bed and read the Sunday paper with me on the couch." That was actually my wife who wrote that. And I've never mastered the tea thing, I have to admit. Men almost never describe the characteristics of their ideal partner in this way. If they imagine their future partner, they think in much more vague terms, a kind of vague expectation of pleasure, like vague physical pleasure. Another list women frequently compose is the list of flawed men. in which they dismiss every man they have gone out with in the last year with a single phrase. There was the slob with sideburns, the law student who smoked too much pot, the gentle Texan who made felt hats but couldn't commit, the physically affectionate banker who always dropped her hand when he saw his friends. Men rarely compose that kind of list either. In general, men tend to write more cautiously about women than women write about men. Love stories are full of romantic delusion, but men and women delude themselves in opposite directions. A woman is more likely to believe her romantic ideal waits somewhere in the future, where her long-held fantasy becomes a flesh-and-blood reality. A man's romantic ideal typically exists somewhere in the past, in the form of an actual person he loved but let go of, or who let go of him. And he keeps going back to her in his mind, and probably also on Facebook and Instagram, thinking, what if? I don't know if men are worse than women when it comes to handling romantic rejection, but they are clearly worse when it comes to handling literary rejection. Even though only 20% of submissions to modern love come from men, they send more than 90% of the angry emails I receive in response to being turned down. This is totally, totally true. To these men, no does not mean no. No means the start of an investigation as to how this possibly could have happened. One man sneered at me, "You didn't even read it, dude." To which I replied sincerely, "Dude, I totally did." Good writing about love features the same virtues that define a good relationship: honesty, generosity, open-mindedness, curiosity, humor, and humility. Bad writing about love suffers from the same flaws that define a bad relationship: dishonesty, withholding, defensiveness, blame, pettiness, and egotism. Writing about love can be similar to falling in love, in that we must be as vulnerable on the page as we are in person when revealing ourselves to someone. That means exposing our flaws and weaknesses and trusting we will be seen as more appealing, not less, for having done so. Thanks a lot.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Emmy Rossum performs after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Well, we've got one more essay for you tonight. I know you want like 15 more, right? We're gonna give you one more, okay? Here to perform it is another alum of the Modern Love podcast, Emmy Rossum. Emmy stars in the Showtime series Shameless. That's all right. You can come on in. Shameless, and tonight she's reading Jochebed Smith's essay, Swearing Off the Modern Man. Emmy Rossum.
Hi. The modern man has an iPhone and goes to Coachella every year. He's thinking about starting a blog and has been, like, really into stand-up lately. He has a favorite microbrewery because he likes his beer really hoppy, whatever that means. He has a fun Twitter feed and interesting theories about what could happen on House of Cards. Peter had all the makings of a modern man. His Twitter feed was super witty. He drank only local beer. He owned one of those weed pen vapor things. He wore cardigans and insisted on managing the music at every party, saying, "Trust me, you'll see this artist on the Coachella lineup in 2 years." Peter was funny, cultured, well-dressed, and well-read, and I took pride in dating a guy who was so keenly cool. But like most modern men, when confronted after weeks of sleeping together with mild inquiries regarding commitment, he crumbled. The modern man is just not into labels and is only trying to have some fun. When I asked Peter what that was supposed to mean, he said, "Chill." Yet, chill, I did not. Later, I met a friend for lunch. "Peter and I broke up," I announced. "Were you guys together?" she asked. "Well, we've been seeing each other for a few weeks." "Yeah, but it wasn't on Facebook." She said, it's only real if it's on Facebook." I was devastated when Peter and I stopped seeing each other, except for the fact that when we stopped seeing each other, we couldn't stop seeing each other because we followed each other on Twitter and Instagram and were friends on Facebook. So I saw him all the time, his grinning profile picture shadowing my feed. "Unfollow him," my friends would roar. "You're never going to get over him unless you unfollow him on all that stuff." But I couldn't. There was just something so enthralling about being able to track his social life. Was he seeing someone else? I had to know. Besides, unfollowing him was too dramatic, as if I were proclaiming, "I can't handle this." Remaining friends on social media, however, showed that I was unfazed. I was cool, chill, and whatever. But I wasn't any of those things. I'd find myself scrolling through his tweets and Instagram posts, which included photos of other women. I'd shove my phone into my friends' faces, their noses practically fogging the screen, and I'd ask, "Is she prettier than me?" One night, drunk, at 2 a.m., I was trying to decipher if an innocuous Drake lyric he had tweeted could somehow be directed at me as a possible admission of affection. Sensing the craziness of that, I clicked unfollow and then unfriend. And with this tiny act of defiance, I was finally free. "This is closure," I told myself. "This is moving on." After that splash of romantic failure, I remembered the wisdom of George Costanza. In a classic episode of Seinfeld, are there any non-classic episodes? George, realizing that his life is a failure, decides he should do the opposite of what he normally does, reasoning that if every instinct he has is wrong, then the opposite must be right. So with this in mind, I decided to swear off modern men. No more Twitter games, no more Instagram dissections, no more Facebook stalking. I wanted someone mature. Byron was 10 years my senior. And he was so mature, he'd say things like, "I'm 10 years your senior." He wore thick rim glasses and grown-up shoes. He hated Disneyland and described things as being like jazz. He didn't have a favorite gin distillery, had never attended Coachella, and was completely off the grid. No Twitter, no Instagram. He didn't even have Facebook. How sexy is that? Byron was old school. We knew each other through a mutual friend and were vaguely in the same group, but had spent little time together. I always had a feeling he couldn't stand me, which I, of course, found irresistible. When we started getting to know each other, because we already somewhat knew each other, it felt as if all the most exciting parts of a new relationship had been combined with all the ease and familiarity of an old friend. The effect was something like spiked hot chocolate, warm, comforting, intoxicating. We engaged in face-to-face, eye-to-eye conversations about books, actual hold-them-in-your-hands books, and about our ideas and hopes, unencumbered by the need to take selfies or choose filters or stare at our phones. We ate at a new restaurant by my house simply because it looked good and not because of the reviews on Yelp written by people we had never met. It was at once nostalgic and refreshing. My Instagram feed had become a vehicle for acquaintances to announce their engagements and celebrate their partners with hashtags like hashtag engaged life. Sitting across from Byron at a nearby bakery, eating cookies and drinking milk, I couldn't help but think that they were just trying too hard. How much time can you be spending together if so much of it is spent taking pictures and writing captions? The modern-day equivalent of shouting it from the rooftops is adding a life event to Facebook, a proclamation of your undying love, until your love dies and you have to painfully switch your status back to single. But Byron was not a life event. He was just sweetly in my life. For a while, as long as we lasted, I wanted and got something quieter. I wanted and got something more intimate. I wanted and got something too big to contain in 140 characters and that couldn't be improved upon by filters. And then suddenly, it was over for us too. I adored him deeply, but in the end, that wasn't enough. Like a star dying, there was a brilliant explosion and then a slow fade. When we came to an end, my instinct was to gain closure in the ways that I had in the past, to rid any semblance of him from my life, my apartment, my phone. But he was already gone. There was nowhere to avoid him because he was nowhere to be found. His online presence was non-existent. He'd left nothing in my apartment, no toothbrush, no sweater. I clawed through my life only to find no trace of him. Except in one place. I held my phone gingerly in my hands, and for hours I reread months of texts, all that remained of us. I lingered over funny or sexy ones, and I clutched my heart at ones in which he called me baby. But after savoring them, I decided to erase those too. Swipe, tap, delete. Now Byron was really gone. Yet, I thought about him every day. I had wanted and lost something that could not be deleted. Before Byron, romantic loss had produced for me mere heartache, a dull, pounding, bruising of the spirit. The loss of Byron had rendered me heartbroken. This wasn't just a bruise. I bled. Yet, it was the kind of pain that seared so cleanly that it made you feel more alive, like the emotional equivalent of getting a tattoo. It was a pain so grand that you couldn't bear but to hold it all, and a pain so exquisite that you just couldn't help but want to. There was something miraculous in caring about someone so deeply in an age where it's considered wise to appear to care about nothing at all. And it occurred to me then, in the trenches of my blankets, enveloped by Netflix and surrounded by bunched clouds of Kleenex, that this was love. And then I downloaded Tinder. I walked up to my first and only Tinder date with heavy feet and a slow, boiling regret. I spent most of the date wondering what Byron was doing while calculating how drunk I would have to get to make this evening not awful. My date spent most of the time on his phone checking out the restaurant we were at that he had picked. I saw some great reviews on Yelp, tweeting that it looked as if it might rain, and posting pictures of his entree on Instagram. Finally, at the end, he looked up at me with eyes I only then realized were green and not blue. The glow of his phone had thrown off their true color. And he said four fatal words. Do you have Snapchat? No, I said, I'm old school. On the way home, I bought stamps. It had been months since we'd spoken, and although I held no hope for second chances, I missed him too much not to say so. That night, I sat down and I wrote Byron a letter, a hold-it-in-your-hands letter. Days later, because letters take days, his name flashed on my phone. Hey, his text read. And then, after a long, pulsing ellipses, I miss you too.
That was amazing! Emmy Rossum, everybody! Emmy read Jochebed Smith's essay, Swearing Off the Modern Man. By the way, Jochebed is actually here tonight, all the way from L.A. Emmy, this is the second story that you read for us, for Modern Love. And the other one was also kind of like a relationship, non-relationship kind of
story. Yeah, the other one was about two strangers that meet on a plane coming back from Birthright Israel. They kind of like each other, but can't get over they can't get past the hump of actually saying, I think I might like you. Can I get your number? And then they like Facebook stalk each other, and then they kind of never end up together.
Yeah. So what was it about Jochebed's essay that made you want to read this one this time?
I suppose I was thinking a lot recently. I saw this talk. I don't know if you guys saw this little clip that went kind of viral about millennials. How the dopamine addiction of the phone. And I know that although I'm one of the better millennials with my phone, it's not actually up here with me right now, that it's a problem. I mean, my fiance and I are totally in love, but we say good morning, honey, and then we go, oh my God, did you see what CNN just sent us? So, I mean, there's and especially right now, I think that there's this... really, like our phone and our connection to the media and CNN and all the updates has become even more intensified. And I think that underneath all that, kind of like feeling like we need to know the information, we need to know, well, Flynn resigned, this happened, Kellyanne said this, and oh my God, SNL, and everything that's kind of fueling my constant, like text conversations with my friend, under that, the feeling is really fear. And so I think that the telephone often keeps us from acknowledging what the true feeling underneath it all is. And so as an actor, your job is to figure out the feeling underneath what the character is saying. And so I feel that, you know, oftentimes, like if I'm sitting at a restaurant and I'm eating by myself and I'll feel awkward, so I'll pull out my phone, when really... it's the moments that we're not looking at our phone when we're just forced to look at the world around us and observe things and actually just sit with our own thoughts, like in a car when you're not texting, when you're driving, when you're just in your car driving and you're thinking. It's those moments that we truly have ideas and come up with things and have thoughts about our own behavior, about our spouse's behavior, about what we can do better, how we can be better, how we can engage with our community in a way that will make us feel productive. And so, in a sense, I only started thinking this in the last like 90 minutes when I knew you were going to ask me this question. So this is not actually very well thought out, but I think that actually my recent even uptick in my involvement with my phone is actually... a problem when I'm not actually acknowledging the underlying feelings that I'm feeling. So I'm going to try to do better about that.
Awesome. Thank you, Emmy.
Thank you.
Emmy Rossum, everybody.
And I owe you all $300 for that therapy session.
Thank you so much. And you can see Emmy in the Showtime series Shameless. She's also done some directing. For Shameless, and she's working on her first screenplay, so quite a bit more to come. Now, Jochebed, forgive us. We have a little bit of tape that you sent us. Is that okay? I mean, the 1,200 people are still here, but because we're going to hear a little bit more about what happened with Jochebed and Byron after that final text exchange. So here's the rest of that update.
While Byron remains a very big part of my life and has always been someone that I hold a lot of affection for, I cannot say the same for Peter, who is basically a garbage can of a person. He and I are no longer on speaking terms. So that's how Peter's doing. I'm still very technically single. I did give Tinder a try, but one of the very first messages I got from a guy on Tinder was, "I'm a block away, do you want to have sex in my car?" And I just threw my phone across the room because everything is terrible. What gives me hope about the dating scene today, as terrible and horrifying as it is that we are all going through the same exact thing, and we can all find at least a little bit of comfort in knowing that you're not the only person who's struggling with this. All of us are, in terrible and magnificent and wonderful and awful ways.
Thank you, Jochebed. Jochebed is the author of Swearing Off the Modern Man, and she works at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, where she's based, and she also does some freelance comedy work as a comedy writer. And by the way, since you're here, I just do want to say thank you to you and all the modern love writers who are willing to have their work brought to life again in the podcast, because you make yourself very vulnerable, first of all, by being published in the New York Times, and then we dredge that stuff up, because some of these essays are all really old, and we ask you to make yourself vulnerable to hundreds of thousands of people yet again. And honestly, the emotional power of the podcast would not be possible if folks like Jochebed weren't willing to bear their souls to us. So thank you very much.
When we come back, more music from Height. Don't miss it.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Next week on the podcast, Justina Machado, star of the new Netflix reboot of One Day at a Time.
I wasn't frigid, fearful, or socially inept. Not overweight or unattractive. I didn't suffer from halitosis or social anxiety disorder. I was a practicing Mormon. And Mormons wait until marriage.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Special thanks to Taylor Blumenreich, Matt Baxter, and Kyle McHugh at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. Let's go out on another song by our special musical guest, Height. This is the song Light off her debut album, Light of a Strange Day, which is out later this month. We'll link to her website at wbur.org/modernlove. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.
I have been here with you once before, and it broke my heart in two to see how I saw you in the light of a strange day when the fog was rolling in. And the sun went down once, and the dog started barking mad. You held my head to your chest so that I could match your breathing. We're growing heavy now, thick with knowing ourselves, tall with the newness of things, feeling so lucky that I can sing all by myself. But thinking of you, nothing compares to the way that I know you and the way you move in me, bubbly, strong. And it broke my heart in two to see how I saw you in the light of a strange day, when the fog was rolling, when the fog was rolling, when the fog was rolling, when the fog was rolling in.
Thank you.